This week on Behind the Lens, the New Orleans City Council grilled Mayor LaToya Cantrell about her decision to lower the speed threshold for traffic camera tickets and why her administration didn't notify the public about the change. Also, will text message reminders help parents dealing with one-app verification for early childhood education programs? The Education Research Alliance of New Orleans recently conducted a study to find out. We'll have the details. And environmental reporter and Behind the Lens host Tom Wright is leaving for Mississippi. We'll get his thoughts on the state of journalism in the Deep South and find out where his career will take him next. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
Mayor LaToya Cantrell and Chief Administrative Officer Gilbert Montagno were at City Council this week, where they faced some heat over an unannounced decision to lower the threshold for traffic camera tickets. Michael Isaac Stein was there. Michael, what are the details of this ticketing change?
So the existing speed limit in school zones is 20 miles an hour, and that's enforced for 2 hours in the morning when kids are getting to school and 2 hours in the afternoon when they're leaving. Since basically these have been put up, drivers have had a 6 mile per hour threshold at which they wouldn't get a ticket. So basically they could drive 26 miles an hour before they get a ticket. The Cantrell administration in February lowered that cushion to only 4 miles an hour. So now drivers are getting tickets for going 24 or 25 miles an hour, which they weren't previously getting. And a lot of drivers have been complaining that they've gotten used to this buffer, that they rely on that to know how fast to go past these school zones. So the Advocate has actually done some really great reporting on this. They got access to a lot of administration emails that showed that there was actually discussion of having kind of a PR campaign around the change. And the justifications given in the emails was that, okay, if this is about safety and we're trying to get people to slow down, the best way to do that is to let them know that this change has happened. And that way, you know, they'll be more careful. But they ended up not going that PR campaign. And that's actually been, you know, the bigger deal rather than the speed limit change has been the fact that they did not inform people.
Sure. And, you know, I've seen arguments on both sides that the speed limit is the speed limit and you need to go the speed limit, not 4 miles over, not 6 miles over. But I think as drivers, too, everyone is kind of used to having a little bit of wiggle room, no matter what the speed limit is. If it's 35 or 40, you know, you have a little bit of wiggle room before you're going to get a ticket. So the city lowered this buffer. What was the impact of lowering this ticket threshold to 24 miles an hour?
Right. And yeah, just before that, I mean, to go on something you said, people are used to a buffer. There's actually like a legal purpose for a buffer zone. And that's basically that, you know, these, you know, traffic cameras are not perfect, right? They're fallible. So giving a little bit of cushion is not only, you know, a kindness, but almost a legal necessity. And the 24 mile per hour limit, according to Mayor Cantrell, was the lowest that she could go, according to the city attorney. So she really brought it down as low as they could. But yeah, I mean, the impact has been, you know, there was an outcry of pretty large proportions. And that's because, you know, we found out that in the first 2 months of this new policy, 41,000 drivers receive tickets for going either 24 or 25 miles an hour. So that's 41,000 extra tickets that would not have been issued without this change. And those added up to about $2 million in fines. So it's a pretty significant impact on New Orleans drivers.
I've gotten a school zone ticket based on, you know, just not realizing what time it was. I know many of my friends who have too. And they tend to be very expensive, which in a city like New Orleans, with some of the income structure we have and as many people living paycheck to paycheck or at a poverty level, those tickets can be prohibitively expensive.
Yeah, no, they absolutely can. And I mean, it's important to remember here that Mayor Cantrell ran on the idea of taking these cameras down. And that's something that really resonated with people because, like you said, these can be very cost prohibitive. You know, I remember when I first moved here, I got two of them, and that was, you know, a pretty big problem for me in terms of just making rent. So, you know, I think especially for a mayor who in part got elected to stop what she called was kind of this ploy to add more revenue rather than increase safety. I mean, that was what she was saying, that she would consistently criticizing the Landrieu administration, saying that, you know, this is not truly about safety. This is a money grab. She, you know, basically criticized that administration for not doing enough studies to prove that these actually made people any safer. And now she finds herself in almost the same position. I mean, you know, for this policy change, for example, the administration studied how much revenue the policy change would bring in, but they did not study whether this would make people any safer. And at a recent city council meeting, the city council brought out their own analyst, Jeff Asher. He does crime analysis for the council. But he came out and basically said that measuring the safety impact of a policy change like this is incredibly difficult because the numbers of crashes in school zones, especially those with injuries, is already incredibly low. The last child to be killed in a car accident in a school zone, that was in 2014. So actually measuring the impact of something like this is nearly impossible from like a statistical standpoint.
What was the feeling in the room? How did city council members react to this whole issue and kind of treat Mayor Cantrell and her administrative officer, Mr. Montano?
There was certainly frustration among the city council members. But at the same time, there was almost a little bit of exasperation, too. I mean, Mayor Cantrell has refused to back down from this, even in the face of all this evidence showing that, you know, not publicizing this was an active decision by her administration. For the council, the mayor came in and basically said she won't apologize. She stands by her decision. And so at this point, I'm not sure if the council is planning on doing much else. But, you know, at this point, the Cantrell administration has done what it's done. That information is out there and they aren't backing down. So, you know, it's unclear, I guess, from the city council standpoint, what the next steps are here.
Michael Isaacstein, thanks so much for your great reporting.
Thank you.
Families in New Orleans use the city's One App system to apply for the publicly funded Early Childhood Education Program. After submitting the application online, most applicants have to provide supporting documentation to verify their eligibility. But roughly one-third of families don't complete this step. Marta Jusen has more.
I'm here with Lindsay Wexler today, who's the Associate Director of the Education Research Alliance. And you guys recently released a study on whether or not text messaging improved early childhood education enrollment. So I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. So as part of the district's One App process, there is a One App that is specifically for early childhood education programs, and that includes all of the pre-K-4 programs that are in public schools in Orleans Parish, and also all of the Head Start and Early Head Start programs that are serving children from birth to age 5. So the system works very similarly to the K-12 One App, where families go online and they rank their choices in order of preference and submit them. But because most of these programs are designated for families who are low income, there's a second and separate step that families have to complete, which is called verification, where you go in person with paperwork to show that you are eligible, that your child is the right age, that you live in Orleans Parish, and that you have the right income level for the program that you're applying for.
And so what led you guys out of what can be, you know, 3-4 step enrollment process, what led you to focus on verification?
As part of their work, I don't know if you're familiar with the New Orleans Early Education Network. So they oversee all of the early childhood program enrollment and the accountability observations that happen in Orleans Parish. So they have public steering committee meetings that I go to so that I know what's going on in the policy. Policy development and the development of this system, which is still relatively new, and that it was an issue that kept coming up in discussion there, that there were relatively low verification rates. In previous years, it's been about only 65-70% of parents have completed that verification step after having gone online and submitted an application. So it's a pretty big drop off, which to me indicated that there was a barrier there that perhaps we could partner with the district to help parents overcome.
And so for this study, you guys sent out text message reminders to parents. About 4,100 parents were involved, and the text went to about 1,200 parents, I believe.
That's right. So the 4,100 is the total number of parents who applied in that year for the Early Childhood One app. This first study, we were focused on just those parents who applied in the first month. So we waited for a month after the application opened, and then took that sample of parents and texted those parents for the rest of the main round window until the verification deadline.
And so you looked at both differences in the program that people were applying for, and then you also sent out different types of messages. One of them was more formal, and then another one was a little more personal in nature. It included the parent's actual name, it had a representative's name, and then it included a little emoticon, yes, smiley face at the yes end, which I liked.
Yeah, yeah.
What differences did you see across those groups?
So we expected that parents who were getting the two big things there were that they were more friendly in tone, and they also invited parents to respond. So almost all of those text messages ended with a question like, do you need help finishing the One App process? So asking parents to respond so that a district staff member on the other end could actually engage with them and try to solve any specific barriers that they were encountering. And we expected that those texts would be the most helpful. What we found is that parents who received any type of text were more likely to complete verification, but we didn't see much difference between those personalized texts and the kind of more formal, just bureaucratic sounding texts. So both of those reminders were pretty equally effective in helping parents complete the verification step. So it seems like for most parents, just the reminder was enough. There was a link to the website in the bureaucratic sounding email that just, you know, here's the information you need. Remember, here's the deadline. And that may have been all parents needed. One result we found that we thought was interesting is that we then looked a year later to see how many children in each of those groups were enrolled in pre-K. And what we found is that our group of parents that had received those personalized reminders, they were substantially more likely to have their child enrolled in a pre-K program relative to parents who didn't receive any text at all, who just got the usual emails, which is how the district has communicated about verification in the past. So that was about a 10 percentage point difference. Those parents who got the formal reminders, even though they were just as likely to complete verification as people getting more personalized texts, they weren't more likely to be enrolled. So it was about 65% of children who were in that formal reminder group were enrolled a year later, relative to 62% of the baseline group who weren't getting text. So it was a small difference that wasn't statistically significant, where we saw 72% of children enrolled if they were getting those personalized reminders. So we're still trying to understand this and doing some follow-up studies to kind of further explore that result. But the one theory we have is that personalized engagement with someone at the district level may help parents feel just a little bit more empowered to recognize that they can ask questions when they have them. They can approach someone at the district or at their school if they have an issue, and might make families more likely to be to still be enrolled or to have found a school that's a good fit for them a year later.
And so what types of questions did parents have when they were actually responding to the district?
Yeah, so we saw one thing that we were really excited about was the incredibly high level of engagement of parents. So of the parents who were getting these personalized texts with questions inviting them to respond, we saw about 90% of them send at least one response to the district, which indicated to us that this is helpful for parents, that they want that kind of engagement, and that they are trying to accomplish this step of completing verification. Of those parents who responded, about half of them had some question that was related to understanding exactly what they needed to do. So where do they need to go? What are the times when those centers are open to complete their verification? What documents do they need to bring? What's the deadline? So a lot of questions about all these specific details to fully complete the process. We saw very few parents respond in a way that indicated that they didn't know what verification was. They seemed to know that that was a step that they needed to complete. We saw a subset of parents who were applying to a Head Start seat. show some particular confusion about the Head Start process, which is a little bit different because of the federal requirements. Head Start applicants have to complete their verification at a Head Start center. And I think that's a little bit confusing because people seem to be more familiar with the district's family resource centers, which provide a lot of services.
And they constantly talk about them for yes. OneUp and the older kids and stuff.
Yes.
So the district resource centers can't handle the
complete the verification for the Head Start centers because Head Start requires that a Head Start staff member do an interview, which is understandable from that program perspective, but it is confusing for parents who are really familiar with the family resource centers. So we saw about 10% of those Head Start applicants clearly thinking they had already completed the process by visiting a family resource center, and they had not. You can't be considered eligible for Head Start unless you go to a Head Start center and complete that process. So that was a particular point of confusion. And we found in this first study that the text message reminders were not particularly helpful for Head Start applicants. They were only a few percentage points more likely to verify, not a statistically significant difference. And we think that part of that may just be the level of confusion around the process, that the text messages just weren't enough to address that. But we're continuing in some other partnership projects with the district to see if we can tailor the intervention a little bit better to Head Start families to help them get through verification.
And how much does this cost if you're running this type of program or sending these messages, reminders to parents?
Yeah, so the pricing is based on how many people you're texting in a calendar month. It's like a monthly system. So it depends a lot on how many people you're trying to reach, whether you're really targeting one population or one grade level or trying to get to everyone, and what how many months you want to be texting them. I would say for something like this where you're trying to target early childhood applicants and getting them through verification, it would be probably in the $5,000 to $10,000 range, depending on whether you were trying to text people for the whole main round or just, you know, the last couple of months. Like, you can tailor it in different ways. But it's a fairly cheap program if you're only sending automated text. One thing that this cost doesn't factor in is how much time it took the district staff to respond to text messages, because especially some weeks when we had a lot of people in the system receiving text, it was a pretty overwhelming volume of text that they had to respond to. And so that's definitely a heavy cost that's not factored in. But just the texting system to send automated reminders is pretty affordable.
And if people want to learn more about this study, where can they go find it?
Yeah, they can see it on our website at the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans.
Fantastic. Lindsay, thanks so much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
You probably noticed a new voice on the podcast this week. I'm sorry to tell you that Tom Wright is leaving New Orleans to head to Mississippi. Michael Isaac Stein had a chance to sit down with Tom for his final contribution to the podcast.
Tom, what's next for you?
Next for me is moving back to my home state of Mississippi. I've taken a job as executive producer at Mississippi Public Broadcasting, MPB Think Radio. I'll be producing the morning program Mississippi Edition. It's on at 8:30 every weekday morning. A lot of people driving through Mississippi will hear this if they happen to be tuning in. We broadcast across the state, and it's a really great opportunity, bittersweet though it is, to get back home, get closer to my family, and serve people there in yet another nonprofit journalism capacity, which really matters a lot to me.
Yeah. So something we've talked about in the newsroom before is, you know, the potential for more coordination between all of these, you know, small but scrappy newsrooms around the Deep South. So, I mean, I want to ask, you know, from your decades of experience in this, you know, how that could work better in terms of the Deep South really kind of combining its journalistic power.
You know, reaching out, communication, and networking strike me as key to anything like that. Just realizing that we have a common mission in terms of what we do, providing news on a very civic-minded, community-oriented basis. I think there's a lot we can learn from each other, not just how to cover the news, but what matters to the sort of audience that we appeal to collectively. So I would suggest that, you know, finding those points of overlap and in terms of the editorial content and professionally will help us all a lot. Serve the publics that we serve on a daily basis.
Episode 28, I mean, that's a lot of content that you've edited and recorded. So give us some highlights for you. What have you liked about it? What's been hell? You know, what's been the experience?
I would say there's been absolutely a bare minimum of hell as far as that goes. I really have enjoyed getting a sense of the high caliber of some of the people who are writing and reporting for The Lens, such as yourself, and finding a lot of validity to the notion that I had coming in that The Lens heretofore, you know, before we really started doing the podcast in earnest, and continues to be a very print-oriented style of reporting, and that's critically important. The hope and plan for the podcast was to simply present that high quality of reporting with another platform. And I found that the ability for you and education reporter Marta Jusen and editor Charles Maldonado and the rest of the folks here at The Lens to really take to that platform and produce an engaging weekly product, I think it's just been a tremendous experience for me. I've been doing journalism for about 29 years, but it's very rare for me to be sort of the point person in this hosting capacity. I'm not a natural by any means, but I've been helped along the way by the smart reporting and presentation skills even of this staff, and that's been a big part of it for me. The other part that's really been good in terms of my experience here has been those frequent opportunities to bring new voices to the conversation. I think that is something we have excelled at in the community journalism venue that more commercially driven media outlets often do not. And I think, you know, I'm very much a First Amendment kind of journalist, and I feel like that amendment in the Bill of Rights came first for a very good reason. And I, to this day, feel that we are at our best when we are truly serving the community. Yeah. And keeping that in mind and letting that guide our actions on a daily basis. No organization in my mind, news organization, fulfills that mission better than The Lens here in the New Orleans and Southern Louisiana area. And it's been an absolute honor and privilege to be working with The Lens in this capacity.
Yeah, well, we appreciate you, Tom. And so the last question, you know, you talk about all these, I mean, how many interviews you've done? I don't know, probably close to 100 at this point.
Close to it.
Yeah. So is there anything, you know, that listener, that any favorites that you have, any that stick out in your mind that listeners should go back and check out if they have some spare time?
See, that's a really good question. There have been some really good ones. I really enjoyed those opportunities where I was able to get into the river parishes and hear from people there, you know, Cancer Alley, if you will, Death Alley, as some activists are calling it now, where the abundance of petrochemical and other chemical industries reside, and where more and more people are growing gravely concerned, and with good reason, about the impact of pollution in their neighborhoods. A lot of those podcasts where I was able to really raise that voice volume-wise really stick out in my mind. There have just been a wide range of really good opportunities to hear directly from people. And so I know that you and Charles and Marta and company will continue to be doing that. So I'll be up the road in Jackson, Miss, but I'll be listening every week to Behind the Lens.
Yeah, well, we're going to miss you, man, but we wish you all the best when you bring your excellence to Mississippi.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your new host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next Friday. And please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org to make a donation today.